This gentleman who is going to be our speaker this evening is one who is known to most of us. Actually, we all agree he needs no introduction. He's a man who has freely, willingly, and generously given of himself and of his time to the carrying of the message to the alcoholic who is suffering, and also words of encouragement to those who might be doubting the value of this program. It's been my pleasure to be acquainted with him for a good many 24 hours. He always has something that is uplifting and rewarding. It's with genuine pleasure that I introduce Dr. Earl M. of Mill Valley. Earl, God bless you.
My name is Earl Marsh, and I'm an alcoholic. How are you? So I'm coming in the front door, and I meet an old reprobate from the South named Al Marino. I can hear him laugh right over there. And he said, "Well, what are you going to talk on tonight?" And I said, "Well, they say I've got to give that blackboard talk." He said, "Oh, no." He said it cost me $10,000 to come up from Los Angeles. Now, how it cost $10,000 to come from Los Angeles, I don't know, but that's Marino. Which reminds me of, there's so many here, I'm sure, that have heard this so-called blackboard talk. I'm a little chagrined to give it again, and almost am inclined to agree with Al, but we will, nonetheless. I recall one time, forgotten how many years ago it was, Chuck Chamberlain and I were on a little AA barnstorming tour, and on one particular evening, I would be chairman, and Chuck would talk, and the next stop would be the reverse. So we were in Sacramento, and I was the chairman, and Chuck was the speaker. And at the end of that evening, a sweet little old soul approached the podium, and she grasped Chuck's hand and mine, and she said, "Gentlemen, I have heard all of them. I have heard Bill Wilson. I have heard Roosevelt. I've heard Churchill. I've heard Gandhi. And you two are the greatest." Well, Chuck and I floated down the aisle about 10 feet off the ground. As we got to the door, we met a little fellow down there who was pretty drunk, and he looked up at Chuck and to me, and he said, "Why don't you two fellas change your pitch? You're keeping me drunk." I recall the 1955 conference in St. Louis. Ickey Sheridan told a story which I'm sure many of you here have heard, and certainly you've heard me tell it, I am sure. But it so typifies the alcoholic that bear with me if I tell it again. Ickey, now deceased, unfortunately, said that in East Texas they had a little town and they had no place to put a drunk if one came along. So they decided until they had better locations that they would put him in the ice house. And sure enough, one came along and they put him in the ice house. And that evening, the sheriff was sitting at his dinner table and he suddenly stood up, bolted from his chair and said, "Oh, Emmy, I left old Joe down there in the ice house. I've got to go down and get him out." So he put on his hat and he walked down the street and he came to a little greenhouse with a great big thick door and a big metal handle, which he opened, and the door creaked open, and there in the semi-darkness over in the far corner was a little drunk all huddled up who looked up at the sheriff and said, "For God's sake, close that door. I'm freezing to death." And so Al Marino got sober and came to AA. Because I have the wanderlust as I talk, they said that I would do better if I wore this microphone. So I'll try to put it around my neck here. Because we might kind of discuss the problems of alcoholism from another vantage point and see what sense we can make out of it. You know, it's a strange thing that in this culture, we have been obsessed for some reason. We've been obsessed. Do you hear a feedback ring? We've been obsessed with looking at all of our troubles from one point of view, and that is early child-parent relationships, those things that happen between you and me and our parents. And we have spent a good number of years thinking about our lives and what's happened to us in these terms. And there is fabulous validity to this point of view. There's no question that you and I, to some degree at least, have become who we are and what we are because of the exposure to our own parents. And this is something for which we are exceedingly grateful. Other times, our parents drop the ball, even as we, since them, have dropped the ball with our own children, of course. No one can do this well. But you know, life is more complex, really, than ascribing all that happens to us in terms of a single cause. There must be other things that function. The human organism is far too complex for us to feel that we have become who we are and function as we do because of one single cause. So though we in no sense decry the psychological features that rest in our hearts and souls, there are other factors too. The ethnic groups that we came to, what we inherited from a cellular standpoint, and the so-called organic makeups of our body. Now, in the disease of alcoholism, as in all diseases, there are a variety of causations, and they all fit together in a given pattern, varying with each disease. And alcoholism is a specific disease that you and I have had, and which at the present time is arrested. And I now speak to those in this audience who are alcoholics. The authorities are beginning to say that probably one of the great factors in the causation of alcoholism is probably a physical one. Now, this doesn't mean that it's totally physical. There must be psychological and sociological factors in the disease of alcoholism, but this is probably a physical disease, at least in its end point, it certainly is. Now, we could talk about the psychological aspects of alcoholism, but tonight I'm not going to do that. And we could talk about the spiritual aspects of alcoholism, and to a large degree, I'm not going to talk about that. You'll forgive me then if I don't talk about those two features, but I don't underestimate their value in any sense. But I would like to speak to you about the physical factors of alcoholism, which, in my opinion, have been too long neglected. Alcoholism, the authorities say, is probably a error in metabolism, just like diabetes is. It's a specific disease. And there are those who say that the alcoholic contains within his body what's known... Can you see this blackboard out there?
Yeah.
Can you? All right. No? What are we going to do? Huh? Light? Well, maybe we better turn up the light. Get a spotlight. Well, anyway, you can see this for a minute. You can see that X, can't you? The X factor. And the X factor, they say, the medical authorities describe the... Can you see it better now? No or yes? Well, he said no. Oh, this thing's in the way, huh? You're out of luck. I don't know what to do.
This is your recorder speaking. At this time, there is considerable delay because the people in the audience could not see the blackboard. So there is time taken while people reset the stage, and during this time, they try it two or three times before the rest of the meeting gets going. Now on with the program, including the delays.
That's fine. Thanks very much. What's he doing back there? Well, the X factor. Anyway. They say that the alcoholic may... That's all right. They can see. I didn't do that. This must be a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know that? Everything all right now? I have to move these chairs now, do I? Wrong again, Jesus. That as well. Monkey Jelinek once upon a time said, and he was the great authority on alcoholism, that perhaps about 30% or a third of alcoholics may well, this was simply guesswork, may well be born with a physical difference in his or her body which might set off or make a diathesis for the development of alcoholism. He wasn't certain of this. And that perhaps two-thirds of the rest of alcoholics in some mysterious way acquired a physical difference as compared to the non-alcoholic. Now, we know that there are roughly 75 to 85,000 adults in the United States who drink, and that there are only about 75 to 85 million individuals in this country who drink, and there are only 5 to 6 million of us. Why don't the rest of those become alcoholics? Well, Jelinek used to say it's because of this X factor. He wasn't certain that was correct. But there seems to be a physical difference. There's some concrete evidence for this. One is that the alcoholic, or many alcoholics at least, utilize sugar in their body different than others do. Blood sugar tends to fall low at times. Lower than it does in the non-alcoholic. So that there's tremulousness, irritability, perspiring, and all those things can come from other causes too, but this is at least one. Some studies have shown that at rest, the blood pressure of alcoholics tends to become lower than it is in non-alcoholics. This leads to sometimes a sense of fullness in the head, a sense of not being quite with it, rather irritable. You know, more members of AA have awakened in the morning and gotten up with blood pressure low and blood sugar low, and they feel like death warmed over, and they've gone to, particularly after these meetings, you know, fabulous amounts of coffee and cake, and you wake up the next morning and you were on about 10 feet off the ground the night before, and all of a sudden you're 10 feet under, you know. And you awaken and you think, I must get the big book. So they get the big book, I'm off the program, and they read the big book, and every word they read they can hardly understand. They wish they could tear the book up, and they get out the grapevine, and they finally say, I guess I've slipped, I'm off the program. Well, they aren't off the program, they're just drunks who just got out of bed and need a little sustenance, a little exercise, and pretty soon they'll be all right. That's one of the factors. Another factor is the alcoholic is a strange person. He's given to either black or white in his activities. Now, many people are, but the alcoholic apparently predominantly
There's an old story about the alcoholic as compared to the non-alcoholic. And in this instance, now I've told this to you before, but let me tell it again. The non-alcoholic will be told by his wife, for example, to cut the lawn. So he goes out and he cuts the lawn for a while, and then he sees a tree, and he studies the leaves and the way that the branches fold together and the way the little veins run down the leaves. He savors this, and his wife comes out and says, "Dear, won't you please cut the lawn?" So he does. He cuts a little further. Then he sees a bird on the wing, and he notices how the feathers lay, and he savors this for a bit. And finally his wife says, "Won't you please cut the lawn?" And so he does, and he gets over to the fence and talks to a friend of his. And so it goes, and tediously but very well, he gets the lawn cut, but with a savoring of the beauties of life as he does it. Next door is the alcoholic, flat on his back. And suddenly the desire to cut the lawn strikes him, and it's cut just like that, and he's back on his back again. So there seems to be little or no moderation in the alcoholic for one reason or another. As Frank Brennan says, we aren't nervous, we're just quick. X factor. Then it says there are some findings. Oh, they say there's unusual kinds of what's known as aldosterone, a hormone that has to do with fluid balance in the body. Many alcoholics awaken in the morning and will weigh 3 to 4 pounds more than they did the night before. Storage of fluid in their tissues, and will feel irritable and tense and nervous. All of a sudden the next night they're up relieving themselves. They lose the 3 or 4 pounds, and as though the shade went up. So it's this oscillation back and forth that's typical in the alcoholic. Then there's some humorous observations. One is that there is less obesity amongst the alcoholics than amongst the non-alcoholics. Now, we have obese alcoholics, of course, but not as much apparently as in the general population. The thirst of the alcoholic is well known. The alcoholic, and I'm not talking about booze now either, we sit around at meetings and we slurp coffee and tea and Coca-Cola and water, and the non-alcoholic looks on in dumb amazement at our injudicious slurping of fluid. We just seem to stuff something into our big fat yaps all the time, constantly. Then they say that the incidence of baldness is a little less amongst alcoholics as amongst compared to non-alcoholics. Now, we have bald alcoholics, but it seems to be less. Every morning when I get up and look in the mirror, I tend to doubt the statistic a little bit. Mr. Marino reminded me of that tonight, too. Where is he? Anyway, there he's sitting right up there. I recall I was talking to a group of general practitioners, a very famous organization known as the American Academy of General Practice. I'm in a surgical specialty. I don't treat alcoholism. I'm not a general practitioner. But nonetheless, I stepped out of my surgical specialty to address the doctors in Los Angeles a couple of 3 years ago, and there were some 3,500 doctors there, and I told them about these physical factors, but some of them in more technical terms, and I told them about the hair, more hair in the head, and the thirst, and the obesity, and the next morning, all over the country, it came out in the paper that I had said that if you're thin and have a heavy head of hair and you're thirsty, look out. It's X factor. Well, we could go on, but apparently you and I in some way are built differently or acquire a different physical setup. This X factor, then, when combined with alcohol, makes then alcoholism in some way. Now, lest you feel that I feel that alcohol is responsible for alcoholism, I don't think it is, any more than gasoline is responsible for habitual accidents. It takes a unique kind of driver, and this is what this unique kind of driver apparently possesses. Now, alcohol is utilized by everybody to diminish tensions. I don't care whether it's alcoholic or non-alcoholic alike. It's to decrease tensions, conviviality, loosens up tongues. We become freer, easier in talking to one another. And even we do this in our early drinking days until finally we go off into orbit someplace, and God knows what happens. But anyway, it's a tension reliever. Now, the non-alcoholic's release of tension from booze is remarkable, but not drastic. The alcoholic takes a drink of booze into his body. The alcoholic-to-be takes a drink in his body. And suddenly it's as though the heavens had opened and God had reached down in all of his bounty and poured manna upon us and said, this is my son and daughter of whom I am justly proud. And it is a glorious experience. Our tensions are relieved in a fabulous sort of a way. Well, this is a pretty good gimmick. If you have, you can get this tension reliever, if you can get this kind of a surcease, this kind of peace of mind. So the alcoholic has a reason to go back to alcohol more than the non-alcoholic does. And over the course of time, as he takes alcohol into his body does what it does to any foreign substance. It builds up a tolerance to it. It gets so it can stand more. Incidentally, one of the X factors is that in the history of alcoholics, long before they ever had a drink, there is the history of being able to take fabulous amounts of anesthetic before the individual is asleep and ready for surgery. We see this all the time in surgery, alcoholic as compared to non-alcoholic. I don't treat alcoholism, but if I have an alcoholic patient that needs to be operated, an old member of AA that falls into my specialty and I'm to operate on her, I will say to the anesthesiologist, now you will see if this patient takes a great deal of anesthetic, and sure enough, almost the whole bottle is gone before that individual is asleep. This seems to be built in. As children, alcoholics give a history that as children they required fabulous amounts of anesthetic to go to sleep for tonsillectomies and that sort of thing. So there seems to be a built-in tolerance to all kinds of sedatives to begin with. That's why the alcoholic early in the game doesn't have hangovers. You know, he can drink a pint of booze or a fifth of booze early in the game and get up the next morning and shake his head and go on to work. While his friend, the non-alcoholic, has taken one-fifth that amount and the next day is vomiting and has an ice cap on his head and feels terrible. These early hangovers are just not common to the alcoholic. It's the hollow leg sort of a business. Well, over the course of time, because alcohol does so much, the individual then builds up even more of a tolerance to alcohol, so that on this given day, he requires that much alcohol to give him the same effect that this much alcohol used to give him. His tolerance has increased. His physical demand for alcohol constantly increases each day, each day, each day, each day, each day that he continues to drink. Make no bones about it. As the days go by in the active career of an alcoholic, he must have more alcohol to give him the desired effect that he is looking for. So he becomes the victim of two things. How do you satisfy an ever-increasing tolerance for alcohol, and how do you maintain social approval on the other hand? Well, the alcoholic, this is the dilemma in which he rests. How can he drink that much to get the desired effect and still have people like him and still have people accept him? Well, he never wins the battle. He never wins the battle if he's destined to losing the battle. And that's another factor about the alcoholic. The alcoholic has a quirk, many alcoholics at least. He'll walk down the street and he will see 100 people, and the last of the 100 will say hello to him or good morning in a gruff way, or may indeed even fail to say hello, and it ruins the alcoholic's day. It's as though everyone hated him. The alcoholic, it isn't important that the alcoholic be number one. It's just that he not be number two. That's always important to him. So, now, if we were to compare the body to, let's say, a bucket, a pan, and if you were to pour into this bucket a half ounce of whiskey per hour, or if you were to pour in this bucket 8 ounces of beer per hour, you wouldn't get drunk. Now, any alcoholic here who is stupid enough to go out and try this will find that what good is a half ounce of whiskey per hour? What good is 8 ounces of beer per hour? You know, this brings up another factor. We talk about our social drinking days. Indeed, maybe we were at one time social drinkers. But I have some personal doubts about this, and these may be incorrect. But, you know, I never can remember in my drinking days of enjoying a single drink. I've done this, made myself do this, but I can't. If someone said to me, Earl, let's go have a drink, I got kind of sick. You know, for what? But if I had the anticipation of an open-end sort of a business where we would go with no stopping, let's go. That sort of a business. I wonder if we were ever truly social drinkers or whether it just kind of looked like it somehow. I wonder. Well, any alcoholic here who wants to go out and try this will find that half ounce of whiskey doesn't do anything for him. So pretty soon he'll be drinking, let's say, 4 ounces of whiskey per hour. Well, if he does, I promise him that only 3.5 ounces of that whiskey will be involved in getting him drunk, because this 1/2 ounce of whiskey will be burned up. So what the alcoholic needs, who has an ever-increasing tolerance, constantly going up, 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 way up like this, and the need for alcohol becomes constantly and daily greater, he needs a fluid balance in his body. He needs more than the ordinary individual needs in his body. And as a result of constantly needing more and more alcohol, he develops a variety of symptoms. One of the first symptoms that the alcoholic develops is gulping. Gulping. Now, gulping is just a simple way of getting more booze into your body quicker, because the tolerance and need for alcohol is constantly increasing. I recall a good number of years ago, I went back east and took my daughter with me. My wife had something else to do, but I took her back with me on an 8 or 9 day trip. She was a little girl at that time. And before I left, I read in the newspaper that there was an actor coming through San Francisco on his way to New York, and was going to appear in a play there, and he's going to portray the part of an alcoholic. And it said in the article that he had formerly had a problem with alcohol himself. And here he was going to portray an alcoholic on the stage. It didn't say he was a member of AA. It just said that he formerly had a problem, but he no longer drank. And I thought it would be kind of fun when I get back there, and I was going to see this play. He was on his way to rehearse, and it was about 6 to 8 weeks before we would be there. And I said, I'm going to see how this fellow drinks. Well, the curtain opened, and out came this fellow, and he had some stage whiskey, and he poured it into a glass and opened his great big fat gullet and knocked it off like that. And I said, there's my boy. I could tell he understood the technique of gulping. Last Sunday night, we had a play entitled Lady at the Rocks down at the On Broadway Theater, which was beautifully done. But the woman who portrayed the part of the alcoholic did not gulp accurately. I would suspect that she was not, or would never become, an alcoholic. She portrayed the alcoholic beautifully otherwise, but she didn't gulp. So we need then to gulp into our bodies in order to get more booze to satisfy this ever-increasing tolerance, and this becomes our dilemma. And the more we drink, the more symptoms that we develop, and by this time, alcoholism is predominantly a physical disease. The World Health Organization says that regardless of why the drinker drinks, regardless of why he drinks, whether he drinks because he's nervous or because he inherited a diathesis or a tendency to develop alcoholism, or because he's petulant, or because his Aunt Emma put him backwards in the pot at the age of 4, it doesn't make any difference. Regardless of why the drinker drinks, it is drink and the results of more drink that make him drink more. So the first thing you know, we're drinking because we are developing symptoms from drinking, and this makes us finally constantly drink more. Our tolerance is increasing. We have a variety of symptoms. Now, you know, the alcoholic is always around the source of supply. And this brings up one factor. 97% of alcoholics will never see Skid Row except as they drive through it in their Cadillacs. Only 3% of alcoholics have ever seen Skid Row. We have some members in AA who have seen Skid Row. We even have a lot of members in AA who have spent a certain amount of vacation time on Skid Row, even as long as a year or two. But these alcoholics are not the true Skid Row habitué. They were just hiding from the old lady or someone or the boss, or they had given up. So we can't say they're real true alcoholic habitués, and I don't mean to in any sense underestimate the miseries of their existence, but nonetheless, only 3% of alcoholics are on Skid Row. 97% of alcoholics are what we now call the hidden alcoholic, the alcoholic who lives next door to you and me, who fools us most of the time. We used to have a phrase in AA that everyone knew that we drank. You know, we get people into AA now that most of them have fooled everyone. They actually have fooled them. They only have the early symptoms of AA. Well, usually around the source of supply, and he makes his drinks here, and the company is in the living room. So he makes the drinks on the tray, and he makes his a little stronger, and he takes them into the living room for the people to drink. And each time he does this, he always makes his a little stronger. And so one day he discovers a little glass which is destined to become his friend. About a 4-ounce glass. You drop it on the floor and won't break. You can keep it behind a plate up here in the cupboard. And as you're making the drink, if he's making his drinks and the drink he's making for himself is still stronger, he still reaches up and gets a hold of this glass, fills it up, knocks it off, and then takes a hold of the tray and takes it into the room. Now, this is perfectly fine, and for one day, as he's doing this and about to knock off the drink, the extra drink, a non-alcoholic walks in and says, "What are you doing that for?" And the alcoholic says, "Well, I don't know. It just seemed like a good idea to take that extra drink." But he deduces something's cockeyed here, and he finally deduces that he better watch out and not drink in front of individuals like that. So the next time that he's making the drinks here, he looks out the door, comes back in, gets the glass, fills it up, knocks it off, and then takes the tray of drinks and goes in to be sure that... The idea is to do it and not get caught. So this is known as sneaking drinks. Now, if you took ordinary surgical ether, this is the kind that we seldom use in the operating room these days, we used to, and you add to it water, H2O, you would then have alcohol. So the alcohol and ether... under certain chemical circumstances, I don't mean you can take a drop of ether and put a drop of water and have alcohol, but under certain chemical circumstances, you then have alcohol. So that ether, you see, as a matter of fact, ether was first discovered by a dentist named Morton in New England, and it was used in ether sniffing parties. I'll bet they were jazzy, you know. And finally it was used then as an anesthetic, and before anesthetics were discovered in 1849, alcohol was used also as an anesthetic. They had a little trouble getting the vomit out of the operating field, but nonetheless, it was so that as the alcoholic has a constant increasing of tolerance and he's taking more and more of this chemical substance in his body, he puts to sleep the frontal lobes where consciousness, I suppose, is located, but he doesn't put together to sleep the pyramidal areas where, which have to do with motor function. He's still on his feet, so to speak. This is then known as blackouts. Blackouts. Now, blackouts are, these are not passing out. This is something that the non-alcoholic does not have. If the alcoholic has a blackout, he passes out at the same time. The alcoholic has a blackout, he may later pass out, but on the other hand, he goes to an interval where he does not remember what has been done because he's just too anesthetized, but his tolerance is so high he can stand it. He doesn't fall on the ground. He keeps going along. And nothing is worse than driving down the highway, being sufficiently removed in terms of time from the source of alcohol, and to have the anesthetic wear off to some degree, and suddenly you're driving a car down the highway having no idea how you got there, or awakening in strange towns, or in strange beds. Things of that kind will now and again occur. The alcoholic awakens in a strange hotel, often phones the bellboy to bring up the newspaper. He's not interested in reading the newspaper. He wants to know what day it is and what city he's in, you know, through blackout. So there are those who say that this is, and I'll just put the initials, toxic dependent drinking with slipping control. This is where the control is slipping. That is where once the alcoholic takes a drink, it isn't guaranteed that he will remember to stop. The alcoholic, one of the symptoms of alcoholism is that the alcoholic's forgetting process tends to increase, while his remembering process after drinking tends to undergo an acute on-the-spot atrophy. He will not recall that it's time to stop. So that we say this is slipping control over alcohol. Now, in the second phase of alcoholism, one of the most dangerous symptoms is inappropriate, and I'll put D. Now, what inappropriate D means, inappropriate drunkenness. Getting drunk at the wrong time. You know, you have the boss is coming over that evening, you decide to have just two drinks, that's all, because you say, well, I sometimes tend to overdo it, so I'll just have a couple of drinks. Then it reminds me of Clark Billingsley, who was a butcher friend of mine, who was a great help to me when I first came into AA. Clark was a great guy to do this. He would, on his way home from the butcher shop, never lost a day's work, but he's drunk all the time. He would buy a half pint of whiskey. He would stop at his door, uncork it, take a couple of drinks, put the cork back in and put it in his pocket, and then ascend the stairs, start to go into his door, at which time his wife, Jane, would reach out and pull him in and smell his breath and say, Clark, you've been drinking again. He'd say, no, I didn't. I've just had a couple of drinks. And he was right. He had just had a couple of drinks. So the famous two drinks of the alcoholic is well known. Then I'll have two drinks, the boss is there, and awaken the next morning from a blackout. So this getting inappropriately drunk. And about this time, here the alcoholic is gulping, he's sneaking drinks, he's experiencing some blackouts. And by the way, many alcoholics never have blackouts at all. These symptoms are not necessarily in this order. There are many alcoholics who've had the DTs and been in the hospital and never had a blackout in their life. But anyway, most alcoholics do rather early in the game. So then the individual awakens one morning, and he acquires a symptom which is destined to be with him the rest of his life, or at least the rest of his drinking life. Nothing pervades him more. Nothing penetrates him more. Nothing breaks his heart more. No word describes the symptom which is destined to constantly be with him, and it seems to locate itself right in the pit of his stomach, and this is a constant, all-penetrating feeling of remorse. Remorse tends to become part of the alcoholic, and he doesn't know quite how to handle this. And about this time, he develops the shakes and sweats, S plus S I'll put down here. Now, no one quite knows what causes the shakes and sweats, or those who say it's because of an upset in fluid balance, and some people say it's due to an enzyme change in the body, and there are all sorts of definitions. But everyone's agreed that at least half of the reason why the alcoholic drinks so much is he's scared half to death. The shakes and the sweats. Then he discovers, if I just had a little bit of the hair of the dog that bit me, I'd feel fine. So he takes a drink and it pops right back up again. And he takes another drink and it pops right back up again. But finally one sticks, and suddenly, as though the heavens had once again opened, the remorse vanishes, the hands quiet down, the perspiring disappears, and once again he is a human being. And this is the morning drink, which so many of us learn to depend on in our drinking days. So I'll put down here, A.M. drinking. Now, incidentally, there are also many alcoholics who've had the DTs or not, gotten in lots of trouble, who never have had a drink before 5 o'clock in the afternoon in their lives. But most of us develop blackouts, morning drinking, the shaking, the sweating, and finally we rationalize this whole process. May say, well, someone say, aren't you drinking more than you used to? Well, yes, but I'm big and strong and I can take it. Or the woman will say, I may be small, brother, but I'm potent. That sort of a business. We rationalize this whole process. Now, if you were to take alcohol, let me bring this A down to here. Alcohol, and you add to it in appropriate concentrations and under chemical circumstances, carbon dioxide, the air that we exhale, you would then have table sugar. So table sugar, ether, and alcohol are almost identical except for that minor difference. Well, you get to taking progressive quantities of booze into your body as you increase this tolerance, and you're gulping more and sneaking more and so forth, and you're getting more booze into your body. You're taking in lots and lots of calories. Well, there's no vitamins, there are no minerals, there are no protein, fat, so that malnutrition sets in. So malnutrition becomes part of the alcoholic's problem. He may get a little fat at this time, but he's undernourished, that's for sure. Now, also the alcoholic's appetite tends to be decreased. His appetite tends to disappear, so he won't eat for days at a time. One of the symptoms of alcoholism is what's known as the chuck horrors. The alcoholic won't eat for 2 or 3 days at a time and suddenly go to the refrigerator and strip it from top to bottom, known as the chuck horrors. Well, the loss of appetite. And finally, you see, alcohol is a sedative but not a stimulant, so you're taking progressively more amounts into your body, like this, and the alcoholic will awaken at night and take another shot and go back to sleep. Then awaken an hour or two and take another shot and go back to sleep. It sedates him and keeps him asleep. But like all sedatives, it finally, usually, reverses its action and does not put the individual to sleep. This is true of phenobarbital and all variety of sedatives. And finally, it reverses its action, and suddenly the alcoholic can't go to sleep. Takes another drink, and he's wider awake. And takes another drink, and he's wider awake yet. And he can't get drunk, and he can't sober up, and he can't go to sleep. And he's just suspended between nothing and nothing, you know, all of a sudden in the middle of the night, about 2 or 3 a.m. So that insomnia becomes the one of the symptoms that the alcoholic becomes the least fond, but it becomes the most consistent. Then, about this time, a series of toxic... You know, it's a strange thing in this shakes and sweats business. I recall a story of a very famous banjo player, guitar player, and a famous clarinet player. They were in a bar in the morning, trying to get a drink up to their lips, and their hands were shaking. They were spilling it in the bar, and the very patient bartender, and weren't the bartenders patient? Very patient. They would wipe up the counter and the bar and pour another drink, and they were trying to get it up, and this had got to be a tedious sort of a mess. They could hardly get it into their mouths. About this time, a non-alcoholic walked in and observed this performance. And finally, he built up enough temerity to say to the banjo or the guitar player and the clarinet player, "Gentlemen, what business are you two engaged in?" He wondered, what occupation? And in typical alcoholic fashion, the guitar player looked up at this non-alcoholic and said, "Well, I'm a brain surgeon. My friend here's a watchmaker, you know, shaking and all this sort of business, you know." Well, what reminded me of this is one of the symptoms that becomes our constant companion is the symptom of resentment. Resentment. Nothing gets us into more trouble than resentment. Now, all people feel resentment. It's human to do so. But the texture of the alcoholic's resentment defies description. This is a fabulous symptom that we develop, and the hatred that penetrates us is totally indescribable. Another symptom that we get, these are all toxic symptoms. We become sick. We're toxic at this time. There's no question. Alcoholism and its end result's a physical disease. I don't care why it starts. It's a physical disease, and that's that. These fellas are sick with all of these symptoms going on. It's all because we're drinking more each day and because our tolerance to it's increasing each day, which makes us drink more. That's the point. But one symptom becomes kind of, we'll kind of like it a little bit. And we tend, it attracts us. It has a fabulous magnetic pull to us. We love to spend hours and intervals in refining this symptom in a way. We like to pour over our heads and into our hair and follow its texture. And this is known as self-pity. Self-pity becomes deeply and intensely refined by the alcoholic. And then the alcoholic walks into the bar one day, and he sits on a bar stool, he looks at the person to his right, and quickly deduces, well, this fellow probably is just an apprentice carpenter, and this fellow over here is, well, probably just an apprentice plumber. But as he looks in the mirror in front of him, he sees Einstein sitting between the two. As he then falls off his chair with his head in the cuspidor, as the carpenter and plumber supposedly say, well, there goes old Joe again. So the alcoholic then gets kind of a feeling that he's almost godlike. It's like the alcoholic often says to himself, I have heard that there's a second coming of Christ, and I wonder. That's sort of thing. So there's this godlike phenomenon. Well, you can see what's happening here, you see. You've got somebody who is gulping, who is sneaking drinks, who's blacked out half the time, getting drunk at the wrong time, filled full of remorse, got the shakes and the sweats, knocking off a cup in the morning and bringing them back up and finally one sticks, malnutrition, no appetite, can't sleep, filled full of resentment, filled full of self-pity, and thinks he's Jesus Christ. You see, that's kind of a sick person. Yeah. For the non-alcoholics in the audience, that applause meant that the person sitting next to you knew exactly what I was talking about. That meant, said that. And then finally the alcoholic says, well, who wouldn't drink when you live in the Bay Area? It's too foggy. I'll go to Denver. It's high and dry up there, and then I won't have to drink. And so he goes to Denver. The trouble is he takes himself with him, and he gets just as drunk up there in Denver. And he says, well, what I better do is go down and visit Marino down there. And I'll go out to Long Beach instead. Not Long. I'll go out to Long Beach. Out there, it's the sea level, but it's sunny and dry, and he gets just as drunk there. And he goes from place to place to place. This is known as the geographical cure. And this is not a very satisfactory way of treating this rather remarkable disease, because it brings up the point, however, that the last one to recognize, and I don't criticize the alcoholic now, because it comes on so insidiously. The disease of alcoholism is an insidious sort of a business. It penetrates at most of us so slowly that we don't really know what's happening to us, and we are the last ones to recognize that we have the problem of alcoholism. Well, there are many other symptoms we could put here, but I won't do that. We'll just say this is toxic, dependent drinking without control. Now, there's still some control there, as we'll see in just a minute. But now let's go to the last phase, which is the phase of true addiction. True addiction, and there are only about 3% of alcoholics here. The alcoholic, under these circumstances, the only thing he's interested in is alcohol. I'll put R-O-H, kind of a chemical radical for alcohol. It's all making a difference. Doesn't want money, family, want to save face, job, nothing. Just booze, that's all. And at this time, he may end up in jails and hospitals. Well, indeed, he may end up in jails and hospitals here, or he may end up in jails and hospitals here. But it's for sure repetitive arrests occur at this time down here. And finally, cirrhosis of the liver, and finally, Korsakoff syndrome, and finally, death. So, the progress of the alcoholic is in this direction, just like that. Now, there's another way we can put this, which might make it a little more explanatory. The alcoholic... Gee, this makes things worse, doesn't it? Now, if you don't mind my drawing on this whiteboard, we might say this. Here is a something like that, like this, and like that. Let's say that all of these up here are symptoms that we have there. Gulping, sneaking, blackouts, inappropriate drunkenness, you know, remorse, shakes, and all the way down to and including death down there. Let's say that this is abnormal drinking, and let's say that this is normal drinking. Now, let's say an individual is here. That would be roughly at, maybe about in there on that scale. We might say that 15% of the alcoholic's drinking is abnormal and 85% still normal. You can fool your friends. We get to this point, let's say down about in here, where let's say 50% of the alcoholic's drinking is abnormal and 50% is still normal. Well, this is a progressive disease. We get down to here where 95%, that'd be down in this business, 95% of the alcoholic's drinking is abnormal, and 5% is still normal. In other words, the alcoholic has enough control left, even at the bottom of that scale, to take time off to bum a dime to get a jug of Muscatel wine. The point is that alcoholism is a progressive disease which goes in this direction. Now, this box here indicates that it takes the average alcoholic about 15 years from his first drink to develop the first symptom of alcoholism. That means that in 1967, the incidence of alcoholism reflects by and large that drinking that started in 1952. Now, there are many alcoholics that become alcoholic from the first drink, or many alcoholics the first year or two. There are many that takes 25 years before they develop the disease of alcoholism. I recall once years ago operating on a sweet little old soul. She was about 73 or 4, looked about 15 years older, like a little wrinkled piece of Dresden china. And after the operation was over, I gave her a half ounce of brandy 3 times a day before a meal. This is a perfectly reputable medical treatment. We now have other medications we use. In those days, this was a popular sort of a treatment. This woman is a pillar in the Episcopal Church, had never had a drink in her life, and I have every reason to believe her. This was the first alcohol she had had. On her third post-operative day, this sweet little old soul was putting back the covers and tiptoeing out of bed, getting to the nurse's desk, stealing the keys, getting into the narcotics cabinet, grabbing out the bottle, taking a belt of brandy, locking the thing, putting the keys back, and going back to bed again. And for one day, we caught her with her gown, you know, just open here in the back, and she was starting to get back into bed, and we wondered how come this brandy was going down and down, and suspected some of the nurses, who maybe they helped, I don't know, but I doubt it. So I said to her, Mother, this beverage is not for you. You see, this woman had been an alcoholic for 75 years and just never knew it. She never took a drink, you see. She had the setup, the physical setup. The X factor was very predominant in this woman, and she allowed us how this was true and that she'd better stop. And, of course, she had not been exposed except for a day or two to alcohol. We had no trouble stopping, but she saw the sense in stopping. But ordinarily, it takes about 15 years. But once the individual crosses this rather elusive line, No one knows quite when it happened to each one of us, what day, what month, what year it was, but we indeed crossed that line. And the older we grow, the more we can think back as to when that day was and can push the day farther and farther back. When the first symptom of alcoholism developed, at that point, alcoholism had its onset, and we did not realize it at that particular point. If you pardon a physiological reference, you see, alcoholism is like pregnancy. Either you are or you are not, you see. Either you are alcoholic or you are not alcoholic, but you may be only 6 weeks pregnant, or you may indeed bulge in all of your maternal delightfulness down here. The trick is that we're all pregnant in one way or another with the disease of alcoholism. You know, if you went into a doctor and the doctor did a routine annual physical examination on you and he took a chest film and he said, you know, Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so, it so happens that I find a spot on your lung. It's a very small spot, by the way. And this spot is tuberculosis, but I wouldn't worry about it. You go out and continue to live the way that you are. When you get a great big hole in your chest, come in and see me. You'd reach across the desk and pop him one. You see, alcoholism is identical to that. With the earliest of symptoms, the alcoholic has then become victimized by a progressive disease which will continue on as long as he continues to drink. He doesn't know this, but this is exactly what's happening to him. There are many people who say, well, you talk about the symptoms of alcoholism. I haven't had all of those symptoms. I've been gulping and sneaking, blackout once in a while, but I haven't had all that trouble. You can always say to them, have hope, you will have. The disease will take over in the course of time. Now, the strange thing is that along this line of descent, there are about 400,000 people in an organization known as Alcoholics Anonymous. Some people of this level, some of this, 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 which we call the bottom. Now, the bottom that this alcoholic comes to may be physically not as disastrous as the one who comes to this bottom, but it's equally as meaningful to that individual. Equally meaningful. We used to have an AA which were known as low-bottom snobs. The low-bottom snob would say to a rather early alcoholic, well, what do you know about drinking? And there was some justification in this, really. He knew more. Then we developed high-bottom snobs who said, well, at least I didn't have to go that far. Well, this is ridiculous. Either both of them have the disease. I mean, the high-bottom will get to be low if he continues on. That's the whole process here. This, then, is an irreversible... These irreversible physical changes occur so that going back to social drinking is no longer possible if indeed we were ever social drinkers. Now, when you take booze out of a person's life, and when he has come to the end and he knows that he must stop drinking, this is a drastic sort of a business, you leave a big hole in his life. He knows he must stop. In order to maintain physical and emotional equilibrium and to maintain himself intact as a human, he must stop. But on the other hand, the hole is still there. What are you going to do? Well, that's where this organization comes in handy. And we then supplant two A's for these symptoms. Alcoholics Anonymous for those two symptoms. And you know, it's kind of a strange thing. 30 years ago, the boss of all said to two drunks, one a stockbroker and one a doctor, you gentlemen are worth nothing. You're not worth a thing. You have lost all of the respect of your confreres. You are in disrepute in all quarters. You are worthless human beings. But I charge you with a responsibility. I charge you to carry a word to this great land of ours. And I charge you to spend the rest of your life attempting to help those of your own kind. And these two men looked heavenward and said, why us? Here, we haven't anything. We are broke. Our honor, our respect has gone. And yet, you pick us. Why don't you take the statesmen of this world? Why don't you take the great physicians of this world? Why don't you take the great physiologists of this world? Why don't you take the great psychologists of this world to do this awe-inspiring job? Why us? We are weak. We have nothing. We are in dishonor. We are in disrepute. And we have lost respect. And the great boss of all said, fellas, don't kid yourself. If I wanted the statesmen, and I wanted the doctors, and I wanted the physiologists, I could get them. No question. Just by waving my hand, I could get them. I want you, and you two alone, to carry something to others like you. And I want you to say to them that one day, no, I say to you, one day you will have an organization which in 30 years will grow to approximate about 500,000. You will be known as an organization which has brought about some of the greatest changes in this culture. You will be held up as ideals for other walks of life. You will have the greatest of respect of those around you because you will have solved a problem and you will be typical American success story. You will be known as the greatest spiritual movement of this age. But, said the boss of all to these two hopeless, helpless men, to the degree that you think you are bringing about great change, and to the degree that you are aware of the fact that you are held in high repute, and to the degree that you feel you are the greatest spiritual movement of the age, to that degree you will get drunk again. This is none of your business. This is my business. The only business that you have is one, and it's a simple one, and that is to carry a message to those like you. And the two men said, what must we do? Proselytize? And the great boss of all said, yes, some of you will. I advise you not to. I advise you to wait in all humility, because I guarantee you that in the course of time, you will be sought out. But you only have one purpose, and that is to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. And so these two humble men, who were worth nothing and who were in dishonor and disrepute, looked up at the boss of all and said, and what shall we tell them? And a thunder ran throughout the kingdom as the clouds parted and there was a blinding flash. And the two men heard, you are to tell them that they are powerless over alcohol and that their lives have become unmanageable. And you will tell this to them because it has happened to you. And then you will say to them, came to believe, came to believe, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision in all desperateness, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Now, not as you understand Him, and not as you understand Him, and not as you understand Him, but as I understand Him. Made a fearless and searching moral inventory of ourselves. And maybe the word moral means morale. Did something which might improve my morale. And made an inventory of those things which could improve my morale. And admitted to God and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. Not that we did things so wrong. They were a little inept, actually. The ineptness of our life. Admitted to God and to ourselves the exact nature of our wrongs. And then we're entirely ready. We're entirely ready in step six that God remove all these defects of character. And then in seven, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Just simply said, please remove these things which seem to stand in the way of me and maintaining some sort of a fruitful, sober life. Just simply please, please give this unto me. And then made a list of all the persons that we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all the people that we might have hurt in this great and glorious descent of ours. Made a list of all persons that we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so might injure them or others. And then you are to tell them that they are to continue to take a personal inventory each day, and when wrong, or for that matter right, promptly admit it. A never-ending process is to go on of looking at oneself in a way and getting back into the human race. And then sought through prayer and meditation, just simple prayer and meditation, to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, not as you did, but as we understood Him, not as you. Yes, praying only, just praying only for two things. The knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. That's all. Have nothing to do. As though we were kind of children who were walking down the corridors of time, just simply saying, what am I supposed to do? And give me the stuff to do it. And keeping this ear peeled for the answer. And then having had a spiritual awakening, if this is what it is, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of all these steps, we tried to carry this message. Tried to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers and yet tried to practice these principles in all of our affairs, everything that we did. This is what the great boss of all said to these two men. And over the course of 30 years, that blinding flash of a day penetrated these two men. And one of them gave up his life in the process in 1950, and the other one is with us hale and hearty today at the other end of this great land. And it has come to pass, it has indeed come to pass, that in lo these 30 years, upwards to 500,000 people of the kind that this great boss talked to 30 years ago have come into this organization and have, in a struggling, desperate sort of a way, learned to revitalize their lives. And much of this with great trouble and great turmoil. And some of the bottom that have been hit by alcoholics after sobriety have been the worst of all. Some of the terror, some of the misery, some of the... It's really the process of learning, which has come the sober alcoholic's way, has often been the worst of all. But the alcoholic has learned that in spite of this, one drink doesn't do it any good. And so he goes on in this terrorizing sort of a way, because coupled with it are oases of glory and oases of grandness and oases of pleasure and oases of relief, which make the whole business perfectly worthwhile. Now, you know, this is kind of a remarkable thing that's happened to these people, roughly upwards to 500,000 people. And one would be at a loss to describe this rather remarkable phenomenon. What is this phenomenon that occurs? You know, it's a strange thing. If you have a bunch of drunks around an AA meeting, you hear, and let's say there's seven of them, if you keep your ears peeled, you'll hear seven conversation, every one beginning with the word I. And yet it's a miraculous thing that this kind of isolated, desperately needful, egotistical conversation of perfectionistic desires, tossing these things in the air with great love and at the same time some hatred, that sobriety occurs. Why is this? What happens? The great doctor was unable to give us sobriety. The great physicians of this land, the men of the cloth, the psychiatrists were unable to do this for us for some reason. And yet, you band together a bunch of perfectionistic, idealistic, irritable, egotistical individuals in one room, and they yak at one another and beat their gums, and in a miraculous way they stay sober. What is this phenomenon? I suppose the doctor might say, well, what you have there is not psychosomatic medicine. Well, all right. Or the psychiatrist might say, what you have is benevolent interpersonal relations. Oh, this is pretty good. Benevolent interpersonal relations. Or there are those who are less doctrinaire and more average who would say, well, what you got is really esprit de corps. But you know, those of us who have seen this for some course of time and who look out in a sea of faces I'm looking out tonight cannot help but say, this phenomenon which occurs at gatherings such as this simply must be God Himself. God bless you all.